This evening we're going to look at depression. Depression is probably the leading cause of disability in the world. The current rate of depression, that is the number of people that are struggling with depression, is roughly 2 to 5 people for every 100 of the population. And between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5 people will get depression at some point in their lives. Now pause for a moment and just think about those numbers and let them sink in. Let them sink in terms of the size of the congregation that you come from and in terms of the number of people that are here this evening. It gives us an idea of just how common a problem this is. And certainly in the field of Christian counseling, where part of my time is spent, this is by far the commonest problem that we face. In terms of a few more facts and figures, more women are affected than men by a ratio of 2 to 1, and the women will all be thinking, yes, it's because of the men that we're affected so badly. Apparently, there are higher rates of anxiety, greater susceptibility to stress with women, and that makes them more vulnerable to depression. Next slide, please. There are some things that depression is not. Before we go on to look at what exactly depression is, or at least what a doctor would diagnose as depression today. Go on ahead there, thanks. It's not, first of all, what I would call Elijah depression. Remember Elijah, go ahead. In 1 Kings 19, Elijah, after the victory at Mount Carmel, long journey down to Mount Horeb, and it's a 100-mile journey, he's done on foot, and Elijah there presents as being depressed. It seems to be that probably Elijah was mainly disappointed that really after the great victory at Carmel, not much had changed, but certainly he's presenting with some symptoms which looked like depression, but not quite what a doctor would diagnose today as depression. Neither is it, next please, what I would call Ahab depression. In a few chapters on in 1 Kings, we have Ahab, remember, Naboth has the vineyard, Ahab, King Ahab, wants to get it. And he takes to his bed and he takes a hump and goes to his bed sulking because he's not getting this vineyard again. Depression can sometimes present a little bit like that. Disappointments can be part of the cause of depression, but it's not quite what we're thinking about, at least what a psychiatrist would call depression today. Neither is it what I would call, next please, Eeyore depression. Now, before you go looking in your concordances for Eeyore, it's not some kind of obscure Hebrew name that's found in genealogy somewhere. Next, please. Eeyore is this character here. And if any of you have children, you'll recognize this gentleman as the donkey in Winnie the Pooh. Eeyore is that character who always has a kind of a cloud over his head. It's always raining. Everything's gloomy. Everything's pessimistic. He has that kind of personality all of the time. And although there is that depressive personality about there, and I'm sure you're all thinking to yourself, yes, I know someone like that. Don't look at them, just think about them. It's not quite what a psychiatrist would call depression. Let's look at what it is next then. How do you know when it is depression and not just unhappiness? Well, a doctor, when he or she is wanting to diagnose depression, they're looking for certain symptoms. And if you have enough of these symptoms, and if you have them for long enough and they're strong enough, it's what a doctor will call depression. So what are these symptoms, and what is it that makes up depression? Just how does this condition affect us? Well, depression affects us as a whole. It affects us both inwardly and on the outside. Inwardly, it affects our thoughts and our feelings, and on the outside, it affects our behavior and also affects our bodies. It affects us physically. So let's look at, first of all, what some of these physical bodily symptoms are of depression. Well, sleep disturbance, you'll see there at the top, is one of the most common. Sometimes people find it hard to get over to sleep. Sometimes the disturbance is at the other end of the night and they waken a few hours earlier than normal and can't get back over. Overall, the sleeping is disturbed. With some people, actually, the pendulum swings in the other direction, and it's more that they tend to oversleep and can't really have enough energy to get up. Next, there is a loss of appetite. Again, a common symptom. People go off their food, they pick over their meals, and it's significant, especially if they begin to lose weight. Again, though, the pendulum can swing the other way, and someone might actually begin to overeat and kind of comfort eat with their depression. Loss of energy, next there, is another common symptom, but it's not just your ordinary everyday tiredness. It's more of a washed out, drained, exhausted kind of loss of energy. Poor concentration. Very often someone with depression will feel that their memory is going. They'll come to you and say, you know, I think my memory is going. I just can't remember things. And it's not actually that their memory is going. What's happening is that they're not really taking in information in the first place. And because it's not registering, then they're not remembering it. But the main problem is really that they're not able to attend to things and to concentrate. Well, there are other physical symptoms, headache, digestive problems, everything kind of slowing up. And especially whenever the movements get slower and the thinking gets slower, we sometimes call that psychomotor retardation. It's not retardation in the sense of a learning difficulty, but more just that everything, you know, slows up and things just don't go as quickly. Depression can also be related with things like constipation and reduced sex drive. Loss of libido can be a very common symptom with depression. Next slide, please. Depression outwardly also affects our behavior. These are some of the things that you will see in a person's life. They stop doing things, sometimes because there just isn't the motivation, there isn't the spark or the go to do their normal activities. They can become withdrawn from people. They turn in on themselves and they avoid social situations. Sometimes people with depression neglect themselves. They don't look after themselves in the way they normally would. They don't look after their self-care, their hygiene, and so on. And then in a number of people, concerningly, there can be self-harm, and obviously that's a symptom that we take seriously. If people are actually wanting to inflict pain upon themselves because of the depression. And that can be for a number of reasons, sometimes because a person just has grown to hate themselves and believes they should be punished. So that's the outward picture, how depression affects our bodies and our behaviours. But next slide, please. Depression also affects us inwardly. And these are the symptoms that people don't see. A lot, as you'll see, of depression is on the inside, and that's a great struggle for people who have depression. It's not as if they've broken their leg and there's a big cast on their leg and everybody can see that there's something wrong. With depression, a lot of the pain and the brokenness is on the inside and is covered up and very often not apparent to a lot of people. Here are some of the ways, then, that depression affects our feelings. Lowered mood, sadness, heaviness, not just your fleeting kind of unhappiness that some of us can get from time to time. This is more of a constant heaviness, a deeply rooted sadness that weighs down upon us. Anxiety, although people can get anxiety on its own, it can also form part of depression, nervousness, tension, worry, heart thumping, mouth dry, but like mine at the minute, tensed up, that kind of thing. That can all be part of depression. People can get irritability, short fuse. You know, someone with depression, they can come across as they just can't tolerate things. And that kind of anger can be part of the condition. Loss of enjoyment, things that normally give a sense of pleasure, just don't hold that same spark anymore. You just don't find that same sense of enjoyment and delight in the things that normally would give that to you. And then for some people, they just don't have any feelings. The feelings seem to go all together. They're just not working. They're just not there. There's no sense of anything, a kind of a numbness or an apathy, as we would call it. Next slide, please. But the depression not only affects how we feel, it colours how we think. colors how we see things, colors how we see ourselves and our past and our present and our future. In terms of how it colours our view of ourselves, we see ourselves in a different way. People can see themselves in a very worthless light. I'm no use, I'm no good, my life doesn't have any value, I'm not worth anything. Or they look at their lives and it just doesn't seem to have any purpose or point anymore. They get up in the morning and they look at their day and they look at what they have to do and there just doesn't seem to be any point or purpose anymore. Someone with depression can look at the world negatively. They take things more personally. They can become more oversensitive. Sometimes they get a thing which the psychiatrists will call ideas of reference. And what that really means is the experience of maybe walking. You walk into a cafe and there's maybe a couple having a cup of coffee over there. And immediately the depressed person will feel that this couple are talking about them. Now, they're probably not. They're probably talking about all kinds of other things, and they've maybe glanced over. But the depressed person feels everything makes some kind of reference towards them. And by the way, some of these things are normal, everyday things that we can get as well, just before some of you start to worry. I get these ideas of reference all the time. So, but we for the depressed person, it's heightened, and they become more sensitive to this. It affects how they see the past. The depressed person will sometimes look back over their lives and they'll pick up on some small thing from the past that had been long forgotten, lost in the mists of time, and suddenly they'll feel this guilt inside and they'll begin to think, why am I feeling like this? Oh, it must have been because of that little thing that happened all those years ago and which I never sorted out, I never apologized for. And suddenly that little thing becomes a huge thing in the person's mind. And these feelings of guilt and sometimes feelings of shame in the eyes of others can begin to dominate in the mind. And then the depressed person, as they look forward, the future can just seem dark. It can just seem black. They look forward, it all seems bleak and hopeless. And for this person, it's important to be checking about suicidal thoughts and feelings. It's something that we'll be tackling in a few weeks' time, and we'll look at in more detail then. But it's important for you to realize that that can be part of the package of depression. Next slide, please. For a Christian, the depression will also affect them spiritually. It colors our mind, it colors our thinking, and for a Christian, there will be spiritual effects. It will affect their sense of fellowship with God. God seems far away. God seems distant. The heavens seem like brass. You try to pray and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Very often a depressed person may begin to withdraw from the fellowship of God's people in the same way that I mentioned earlier that withdrawal can be a natural consequence of how we're feeling. For a Christian, it means maybe not going to church and not feeling they can be in Christian company. Excessive guilt or unresolved guilt. Now, of course, guilt is not necessarily a bad thing. There is, of course, appropriate guilt. But, of course, as Christians, we go to the cross and we have that guilt dealt with there by what Christ has done for us. And yet for a Christian with depression, although they will know all of that in their minds, they don't feel it. And for them, there's a successive sense of guilt, even though they may know intellectually what Christ has done for them. It will affect their sense of joy and peace and can rob them of that. There can be difficulty praying. Concentration, as I said, is gone. Motivation is hard. Praying then is difficult. And if you don't feel God is near, well, then the motivation sometimes to pray is taken away as well. Reading your Bible is hard. Worship doesn't seem to have the same sense of joy that it normally would. Now, whenever you add all of that together, you can understand that a Christian that's struggling with depression will very often have difficulties with their sense of assurance. Should a Christian feel like this? They'll say, I don't see evidences that I am a Christian. What's the devil doing to me? Are some of the responses. And so we can see that feeling like this can create huge dilemmas for someone who is a Christian. Lots of questions. Although the thinking is very often with depression pushed then towards this kind of negative extreme. Very often a person, though, with depression can be reasoned with. You can talk with them, you can try and help them to work with their thinking. Next slide, please. But sometimes we can't do that. Sometimes a very severely depressed person just cannot be reasoned with. The thoughts, the depressed thoughts, get very strong and very hard to shift and very fixed. And when a person develops these kind of false fixed beliefs, we call them delusions. And that can be a depression which tips over into what the psychiatrists will call a psychotic depression. It's a very severe depression where the thinking becomes very extreme and fixed, a severe depression with psychosis. Now, just to explain that a bit further for a moment, a psychosis is a condition in which a person loses touch with reality. The thinking and the perception of things just loses touch with reality. And in depression, then, some of these psychotic symptoms take on very depressed themes, the guilty delusions, the delusions of worthlessness, that those worthless thoughts which just cannot be reasoned with. Sometimes a person with this kind of depression will think that they are dead inside, or that people around them and the world around them seems dead, and we call those nihilistic delusions. And sometimes the mind plays tricks on them to the point where they get voices which are of a very critical and derogatory nature. You can appreciate that these are very distressing symptoms to have. Agitation is very common with that kind of depression, that slowing up of things that I mentioned earlier, and especially with this kind of depression, suicidal thinking and suicidal risk is very important to watch out for. Just mentioned a few other conditions there, just because you'll probably have heard of them. Bipolar mood disorder is where a person gets phases of depression, as we've described, but also then the mood can shoot up and overshoot the normal into a kind of a high phase lasting weeks, sometimes even into months, where the mood can get quite elated and high. Everything speeds up. There's a bit of overactivity. Thinking speeds up. Speech can speed up. The person then, in the same way that a depressed mood colours the thinking in this condition, the elated good feeling colours the thinking, and everything is bright and breezy, and sometimes that person can get very grand ideas, and that's characteristic of bipolar disorder. There are just a few other conditions that I've mentioned there that can have depression as part of the picture. So I hope that as we've looked at what depression is there, you've seen that depression is much more than just unhappiness. Now, you don't have to have all of those symptoms, rather, to have what a psychiatrist will call depression, just a number of those symptoms occurring together over a number of weeks, strong enough you're not able to shake them off, and you'll have what a doctor would diagnose as depression. Just a word or two about how these symptoms tend to develop. Next slide, please. They tend to feed into one another in a kind of a downward spiral. Let's come back to John. Remember, you were talking to John in the Sunday school room. You find out that John's job has been under threat. And as he began to think about the future, his sleeping becomes poor. Because his sleep has gone off, he becomes exhausted. Small problems become huge problems, as they do for all of us whenever we're underslept. John's become snappy in his relationships at home. He's feeling guilty that he's like Jekyll and Hyde with his wife and children. He then begins to feel worthless about how he's presenting himself at home, and he's losing his role as a breadwinner. And as all of these symptoms begin to tumble into one another, this black cloud of gloom descends over John and then colours his whole thinking, and reinforces then this whole idea that he is worthless and that there's no purpose to his life, and so the whole thing spirals down into this turmoil and despair. And it all sounds very pessimistic, but actually it's important to recognise that that's how depression develops, because By the same token that that's how the thing develops, there's a clue there to how we can begin to work our way out of it. That even working in one small area and seeing some improvement there can sometimes have just a bit of a knock-on effect on another and so on, and begin to help a person up out of depression. And we'll come back to that before we finish this evening. So we've seen then a little bit about what depression is, and we've looked at how it develops. Let's look next, thanks, at how a depression comes about, what causes this condition. These are some of what we call the risk factors for depression. All it really means is things that will increase a person's likelihood of developing depression. And one of the major ones there is life events at the top of the list. Major happenings, major changes in a person's life are thought to precede over 2/3 of cases of depression. And the kind of life events that we're thinking about are particularly losses, things like bereavement, loss of a job, marital difficulties and separation, even things like children leaving home or moving house or illness or any unexpected change of direction in your life. All of these kinds of events that involve a change, that involve stress. And it doesn't have to just be one major event. It can actually be a number of smaller things, any one of which in and of themselves might not lead to depression, but there's a kind of what we call a kindling effect of these smaller events which come together and can lead to depression. Also, it doesn't have to be the case that suddenly there's an event and then bang, the depression hits. It can be the case that there's an event here and even a gap then of a number of months before then the depression begins to hit home. Interestingly, one of the important things about whether or not a life event will lead to depression is thought to be how the individual perceives that event. In other words, if I see that event as negative and as threatening, and particularly then if I see myself as being responsible for the event, then that kind of life event is more likely to lead to depression. There then next is a thing there called endogenous depression. That just means depression which is from within. That's what the word means, depression that arises up out of the blue. There's no life event, there's no obvious cause, it just comes over a person, and that can be often a way that depression presents. Relationships, people with less supportive relationships are more prone to depression. Family history, depression, as any of you know who have had depression in your family, may realise that there is a genetic component to that, and the children of someone who has suffered from depression are at a greater risk than the general population, roughly by about 3 times. Now, that doesn't mean that it's inevitable that it will be passed on to children, but it does mean that there's a greater risk and there is that physical genetic component to it. Early experiences are also relevant, particularly things like someone who's grown up in a home where there has been parental discord, or where there has been maybe a lack of parental care, maybe coldness or distance, or a lack of acceptance and harmony within the home. And also, inevitably, homes where there has been childhood abuse. Those children will be at more risk in adult life of developing depression. Personality, well, we mentioned poor old Eeyore earlier, and certainly those with maybe more of a pessimistic outlook and a tendency to look down on themselves may have more of a tendency towards depression. Also, those of us who have a personality where we're a bit more easily overwhelmed by stress, where we're more anxious, even those people who are a bit more obsessional have maybe quite high, rigid standards about things and about themselves and even their own expectation of themselves, they can be more at risk of depression as well. Gender, I did mention that ladies are at greater risk. The social environment, again, living in a social environment where there's more adversity and less support, that may place a person at greater risk. And then next, an important one is physical illness. There are some medical conditions out there which can have depression as part of the package. Thyroid disease is a common one that doctors will often test for in someone who presents with depression. An underactive thyroid can lead to depressive symptoms. Also things like anemia, a low blood count, infections, diabetes, actually, heart attack, post-heart attack or post-stroke, there can be a greater risk of depression during that period. And also Parkinson's disease is recognised as being associated with depression. Now, the importance of knowing some of those conditions is that in some of them, for example, the thyroid disease, correcting the medical condition will also lift the depression. And so that's why it's important for us to bear that in mind, that could be one of the causes. Alcohol and drugs. Alcohol is a depressant. So those who have a difficulty with alcohol may often suffer from a kind of a low-grade grumbling depression. Drugs as well. It's not uncommon these days to find, especially those drugs that give a person a bit of a high or stimulants, will often have, as well as the upper, the downer, and can lead into a period of depression. And medication, it's important again to remember that actually some medications can have depression as a side effect. The key there is linking starting the drug or a change in the dose of the drug with the onset of the depression. Some of the culprits there are things like beta blockers or drugs for blood pressure, cholesterol-lowering drugs, which a lot of folk are put on today, also medication for acne, and also tablets which are used for epilepsy can also have depression as a side effect. And lastly there, at the end of this big long list, previous history. Someone who has had a previous episode of depression does have a greater risk of having depression in the future, and it's thought that maybe even up to 80% of people or more who have had one episode will go on to have recurrences in the future. Next slide, please. Now, let me just take some of those causes of depression. Remember where we're asking this question, how does this condition come on? And let's look at some of those just very briefly from a spiritual perspective. We saw that life events, for example, often can precede cases of depression. But where do these life events come from? How do we see life events as Christians? Well, some life events certainly are contributed to by our sins. We get into conflict with people, leads to divorce. Maybe behavior at work leads to a loss of a job, for example. Sometimes these life events can come as attacks from Satan, but ultimately whatever is going on in our lives is under the control of God. Remember what we read in Ephesians 1, that God is one who works all things according to the counsel of his will. And so we have this God who is sovereign over the losses and the stresses and the unsupportive family and the adverse childhood experiences, all of them under the care and the control of God. What about the fall? Well, we mentioned in that list of causes that temperament has an impact upon depression. What about this weakness of my mind that can sometimes lead into depression, which predisposes me to get depressed? Why is it that I have a makeup that can get depressed at times? Well, the Bible teaches us, doesn't it, that after the fall, all of creation was subject to the effects of that fall, to the effects of corruption and decay. That is, in all of creation, including our brains, including our physical makeup, subject to those effects of the fall. Our emotions and our personalities and how we're wired together, all of that affected by the fall. And that's why we're prone to depressed mood and to sorrow and to tiredness and to poor concentration. It's interesting, actually, if you go back to Genesis 3, where the fall occurred, that it's very, very soon afterwards we begin reading about pain and sorrow and tiredness and so on, and the kind of symptoms that we're talking about that are also part of depression. We live in a fallen world. We have fallen bodies. We live in a fallen world where lots of negative, difficult things happen. And so we see that as a cause, too, of depression. What about me? How do I contribute to depression? Well, we all have hearts which have a tendency towards thinking in the wrong way, hearts which are sinful, which are bent towards believing lies rather than truth, and we'll come back to that later. Remember what we said earlier, that very often how we see life events has an impact upon how they affect us. And so we have this colouring how we see events and the effect of sin in all of that. Then, of course, we have an enemy out there who's just wanting to exploit every weakness, who's wanting to get a foothold at every point, who will love to come and reinforce those preoccupations of guilt and worthlessness and hopelessness that the depressed person faces. And then, of course, we live in a world, don't we, which is against us, which says that suffering has no good purpose for us, which tells us that feelings are everything and feeling good is everything, and which places our hope and our purpose and our worth in things really that are perishing. And we can see then that all of those things will also feed in the background into depression. A couple of important questions just out that I want to address at the bottom there, because these are questions that very often people will ask. Is depression a chemical imbalance? Well, we've just said certainly the brain is involved, and we do live in fallen bodies. We know that there are changes in blood flow, there are changes in some of the chemicals in the brain in depression, but what we don't know is whether those things are a cause of the depression or if they are an effect, and we get into this kind of chicken and egg argument about that. So certainly chemical changes are involved in depression, but it's not so simple as to say that it's all down to chemical changes, and our brain actually is filled with hundreds of these chemicals and what they call neurotransmitters, which are involved in our mood and in things like depression. So a chemical imbalance is certainly involved. We just don't know if it's cause or effect. Now, what about this question? This is a thorny one. I'm going to ask it before you ask me, and that is, does sin cause depression? Well, we do know that unresolved sin in a person's heart, in a person's life, can cause guilt, and that's appropriate and right that it should. And of course, that's there to try and drive the person towards the right answer for that guilt, which is in Christ, and it will cause a lack of peace for that person. And we read in the Psalms that that kind of unresolved guilt can certainly cause pain and distress. Let me quote you some well-known verses from Psalm 32. When I kept silent, psalmist writes, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. That really does describe very effectively the kind of energy loss that we get in something like depression. But in this particular example, it was a case in which the psalmist had unconfessed sin. And so I think it's fair to say that sin that hasn't been dealt with properly can lead to the guilt, which can then tumble into some of these other symptoms that we've discussed this evening. We've already seen that someone who is already depressed can have then a heightened sense of their guilt already, and that can be very disabling. But none of that is the same as saying that depression is sinful. In the psalm that I began to read to you earlier this evening, Psalm 42, and also the following, Psalm 43, which seemed to me to be probably one song altogether. In those psalms, we certainly see a believer who is struggling with depression. And yet, really, I don't see any evidence there that this man is sinning. There's no evidence, at least, of it in those Psalms. Yes, he's struggling. Yes, there's a real battle of faith going on, but it seems to be in a godly man, and we don't see necessarily evidence of sin there. Other Psalms teach us that a believer can be in darkness without sin. Psalm 88 is a well-known one where it talks about darkness being my friend. And of course, there's Psalm 23. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, yet will I fear no evil. There we see a Christian going through a shadowy valley and yet not fearing evil. No evidence necessarily of sin there as the believer is being led through the valley of the shadow of death. Isaiah 50, verse 10, another reference here where we see an obedient, God-fearing believer who walks in darkness and has no light. But for me, the greatest example is over in the New Testament, where we see a man kneeling in a garden, and we read of him as he is praying on this particular night that he is exceedingly sorrowful and deeply distressed. Of course, we're talking about Jesus. Now, I'm not a Greek scholar, but I'm led to believe that whenever we're told there that Jesus was deeply distressed, that of three Greek words that can be used for depression, the one there that is used is the strongest of those words. And so there we have the Lord Jesus, our Savior, sinless, struggling with deep distress, struggling with feelings of depression, such that as he looks forward to what is before him, he says, Father, let this cup pass from me. Those are words in Matthew 26. So we can have these experiences, and yet they are not necessarily sinful. Certainly, yes, depression can be the occasion for sin, the occasion for unbelief, the occasion for not trusting the Lord. But it is not necessarily sinful. You can respond in a sinful way, but the experience of the depression is not in and of itself a sin. Well, you can take me to task about all of that afterwards if you want. I'm going to head for the door here quickly afterwards and make an escape. But I'm happy to chat with anyone about any of these issues afterwards. Let's then move on and tackle, finally, the whole issue of what we do with depression. We've looked at what depression is. We've seen what can cause depression. Let's look at what we can do about it. Next slide, please. The first thing, just to notice, you'll think, what on earth is this picture of a squiggly line mean? Anyone who's ever struggled with depression will know that very much the course of getting better from depression is a very rocky road. It's very much up and down, good days, bad days, better day, better day, better day, awful day, and you feel you're back at square one. And the important thing is, next bit please, that we look not just for the day-to-day change, but we look at the overall trend and that you see how things have been over the last number of weeks. So whenever you hit a bad day during your recovery, don't feel everything's right back to the beginning. It usually isn't. It's usually just a case that it's a very bumpy ride, and the overall trend is the important thing. Next slide, please. So what do we do then in terms of helping someone with depression or trying to recover from it ourselves? Well, I think the first thing to do if you're trying to support someone, help someone, is to gain an understanding of what this person is going through. So let's come back to John as you're talking with him. Sit down with John and listen to him. Let him tell his story of how this developed. Feel what it is like in John's shoes. Whenever James in his epistle, in chapter 1, says, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. What James is saying there is be an active listener. Listen carefully. Listen and try and gain such an understanding that you know what it's like for that person in their boots. Listen with that kind of ear. And then next, show fellowship. We are called as Christians to share in one another's lives. Don't underestimate the courage that it takes for someone to open up to you and to tell them that they're feeling the way they're feeling. It takes immense courage, because very often they're so ashamed of how they're feeling inside. And here's an opportunity for you to bear this person's burden with them and to fulfill the law of Christ. One thing just, you know, that if someone does confide in you about how they're feeling, be careful about confidentiality. Please treat information like that sensitively. Never speak to anyone else without saying first to the person that you're dealing with, and be very, very careful to keep the information confidential, because if you lose the confidence of the person who's spoken to you, you lose that relationship and you'll not be able to help them at all. Next bit, please. Next thing, it should go almost without saying, a visit to the doctor. We've said there are physical causes, but also because medication might be helpful. And next slide, please. Just want to take a moment to mention about medication. Just keep pressing the button there and we'll go down some of these. There are different types of medications. There are older ones, there are newer ones. Yes, there are a few of them there at the side. I'll not go into them in detail, but basically they all work in much the same kind of way. The older ones tend to have a few more side effects. There are a whole range of antidepressants out there. Unfortunately, we're not sure which ones work for what kinds of depression and what kinds of people. So very often, it's a bit of hit and miss to get the right kind of treatment. Do they work? Yes, they work in a good number of people. The statistics would say that it's roughly about a third. My experience would be maybe a bit more than that. But whilst they're not everything, they can play their role and they can be helpful. How long do they take to work? Well, normally they take a while. Normally you'll not see much improvement before a fortnight, and usually 4 to 6 weeks before you see any significant change. So you've got to take them every day, just patiently and waiting to see if there are any rays of light that come through. Do they have side effects? Yes, they can have side effects. Usually the first number of days, things like stomach upset, a bit of sedation, that kind of thing, blurred vision, dizziness with some of them. But that will often go away. If it doesn't, it means just that you're not able to tolerate that particular preparation. Will I be able to stop them? People get worried that maybe these antidepressants are addictive. They are not addictive in the sense that things like other medications like Valium and so on can be addictive, or alcohol, where you begin to take it because you want the feeling and you want to take more and more of it. Antidepressants are not like that. They don't give you a buzz or a high or anything like that. But you do have to be careful stopping them, because if you stop them too abruptly, you can go into what's called a kind of a withdrawal or discontinuation syndrome, which isn't very pleasant. So never ever, even in a well-meaning sense, tell anyone to stop their medication. It's very important that it's supervised and that the stopping is gradual. Do they help? Well, as I've mentioned, yes, they can help certainly a number of people, and often I would see them as having some role in helping folk, even though a lot of people I'm seeing would be in the whole realm of counselling and the talking end of things. Okay, next slide, please. Let's move on from the medication and come back to how we can help people practically and through talking and so on. Very often, if you're with someone who's got all of these symptoms that I've mentioned, with all of these potential causes, it all seems so complicated, and you can feel overwhelmed. And the question is, well, where on earth do I start in trying to help someone with these problems? I think one of the maybe important questions to ask at the beginning is, well, what are the issues? What are the main problems in the midst of everything else? And that can often be a good place to start, or even to focus on the kind of things where change can be made, and leave maybe the bigger issues for on down the line. So trying to help with things like some underlying causes, if grief or debt or stress or even abuse or relationships are a problem, sometimes going in and trying to help with those underlying things can help. But next, please. What I would say is that we can all, I think, to some degree, give practical encouragement. Practical encouragement. Now, whenever I use the word encouragement there, I really mean encouragement in the sense that the Bible means encouragement. In the New Testament, the word encouragement has this idea of urging someone along, strengthening someone, comforting someone, urging someone on in the context of a very close relationship. I often have the picture in my head of the kind of help and advice you give to someone with your arm around their shoulder. It's that kind of practical urging someone forward and encouraging them in that sense. And I've given it just a few words there as pointers to particular areas where you can help. Be practical. If motivation is a difficulty, for example, if someone just can't get going and they're sleeping in and their whole day has become unstructured and a bit of a mess, then help them to begin to reintroduce a bit of structure again in their day. That can be very helpful. Just beginning to get up again at a regular time, trying to get eating times back into some kind of regular rhythm again, getting up, even small things like getting washed, getting dressed. That kind of daily structure and beginning to reinstate that can be a great help to someone who has lost all that. It can be a terrible struggle to regain that kind of order and structure from day to day in someone who is struggling with depression. And just introducing that little bit of routine can give someone that little bit of hope, that sense of purpose that says, you know, things are not just as bad, I can begin to do some of these things again. Then next is activity. Try to encourage someone to restart small, enjoyable activities. Now, don't start with anything too big. As you're helping them structure their day, start to timetable in just a few small goals, a few small tasks to try and meet during the course of the day. It might be activities like walking. There's good evidence out there that light exercise can actually be quite helpful with depression. But even if there are other activities that the person has given up because of their depression, things like gardening or music or whatever their thing is, try and just gradually help to reintroduce that into their lives. Especially things that are enjoyable. Now, bear in mind that the feelings aren't working in quite the right way. That sense of enjoyment may not be there. But just trying to reintroduce those small things again can just give the opportunity for those little sparks of pleasure and enjoyment to come back again, which can be just the first signs of things beginning to get better. Even as for Christians, encouraging them to go out for a walk, and even if they can't sit down and take in a sermon, or if they can't really sit down and read a passage of their Bible, but just to go out and walk through God's creation and let creation preach its sermon and begin to enjoy the scenery and the things that God has made. Remember how often Jesus picked up just little pictures that were in nature, you know, the birds of the air and the flowers of the field, and through those taught us lessons. And for a depressed person, getting out and out for a walk and beginning to let nature preach those kind of sermons and lessons back to them, God's general revelation, if you like, can be helpful to them and can begin to encourage them again. Thirdly, there, pay attention to the body. And by that I mean, again, eating. Again, the appetite can go, but just to try and encourage getting back into regular eating times, meal times, and starting to try and eat small amounts again and building that up, trying to get the proper amount of rest, even if the sleeping doesn't seem to be there, can be helpful. And I think it's one of the things that we can actually learn from Elijah back in 1 Kings there. It's interesting, isn't it, that whenever Elijah is in this state and is wanting God to take away his life, God doesn't come in and preach a long sermon. He doesn't come in and hand him a big theological tome to read. He tells him to sleep, and he provides food. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, and I think that we can learn a lot from that, that God saw the bodily needs that Elijah had that were going to help him, help to restore him at this time. And then finally there, I've mentioned safety, making safety a priority. And there, what I'm really talking about is, again, needing at times to check for suicidal risk for those that are feeling hopeless and feeling worthless. Something, as I say, we'll look at in a bit more detail in a few more weeks. So there's practical encouragement that we can give. Next, we can give some spiritual encouragement. and we'll finish with this evening. You'll notice in the verses that I read to you from Psalm 42 that the psalmist says to himself, "Why are you cast down, O my soul? Why are you down?" He's talking to himself. And one of the things that we can do in depression is the depression is doing a lot of talking. The depression talks a lot about how worthless you are, how pointless your life is, and how bleak the future is. And what we can encourage people to do gently is to begin to talk back and to talk to themselves and to talk to their own souls. Even though they don't feel it, they can talk truth to themselves. And we need to remind people that faith is not a feeling. Now, we need to be careful here. I think we, even as Christians, rely a lot more on our feelings than we would be prepared to admit. Very often, we will gauge the kind of quiet time we've had or the kind of sermon that we've heard or the worship time that we've had by the kind of feeling we have whenever we come away. If we feel God's presence near, if we feel that sense of cleansing, if we feel a sense of joy, we'll say, yes, that was a good time with the Lord. And yet in depression, the feelings, as we've seen, are broken. They are sick. They're not working properly. And in that situation, a believer then is called to faith. The kind of faith that will hold on to believing something even whenever they don't feel it. It's the kind of faith, I think, that Hebrews 11 begins with when it says that faith is the evidence of things not seen, or that faith is the evidence of things that we don't see, things that we don't perceive, things that we don't feel. And it can sometimes, for a depressed person, feel that it's just all intellectual, and yet sometimes the Lord calls them to hold on by faith to these truths, to these convictions, even whenever the feelings are not in line. Which brings us on to the next question, which is, what do I do then with the wrong feelings? What do I do when it feels as if I've lost my joy and I've got no peace? Well, the Bible does give us some counsel about how we find joy and peace, and I think what I would say is that Christians at least need to put themselves in the place where that joy and peace can come back. Rejoice in the Lord, Paul says to the Philippians. So the rejoicing has to be in the Lord, in remembering who the Lord is and that the Lord is Lord of your life, and in following that Lord, your rejoicing is in that. It's not in your depression, but it's in the Lord. What about that lack of peace? Well, again, we may not feel the peace. It may be all turmoil in here, but at least we can still try to follow Paul's exhortations when he says, you know, pray in everything, be anxious for nothing, think the right things, and the God of peace will be with you, even whenever at times we don't feel that. And so we try to put ourselves in the place where we can find that joy and peace again and wait for the feelings to come back. It will also involve dealing with sin where sin is there. Sin can rob us of that joy and peace. And of course, we need to deal with that whenever it's there as well. What about whenever we feel that fear and depression? I feel afraid. Well, we try to face that kind of fear with trust. It's very interesting that the most common command in the Bible is